All right. This is such an incredible treat. I was told, I don't know if you heard this, the last people to sit in these chairs was Oprah Winfrey. So if anyone finds a set of keys to a new car under your seat, that's not from us. That's from a prior event. Ladies and gentlemen, this is one of the honors of my career. I've been excited about this for weeks. Peter needs no introduction, of course, in this room, but I'm going to give him one anyway. He asked me not to do a long introduction so that we don't embarrass him, but I got a couple of things I got to say. Is that okay?
Sure, please.
All right. All right. Peter is vice chairman of Fidelity Management and Research, the investment advisory firm of Fidelity Investments, where he has worked since 1969. He is also president and chairman of the Lynch Foundation, which supports programs that focus on education, cultural and historic preservation, healthcare, and medical research. From 1974 to 1977, Peter was director of research at Fidelity. And from 1977 until his retirement in 1990, he was manager of the Magellan Fund at Fidelity. During his tenure at the Magellan Fund, Peter averaged a 29.2% annual return consistently.
That's right.
Consistently more than doubling the S&P 500 market index, making it one of the best performing mutual fund in the world and the best 20-year return of any mutual fund ever. During that time, Magellan's assets under management increased from $18 million to $14 billion. Ladies and gentlemen, Peter Lynch. All right. Anything you want to get off your chest before I start?
Let's roll.
Yeah. All right. There are a lot of reasons why you're on the Mount Rushmore of the greatest investors of all time. One of them is obviously your track record. Another is how much wisdom you are willing to share with everyone else via books and interviews, which back then was very rare. But among your greatest achievements is the fact that you went out on top, literally at the height of your popularity and your performance in 1990. That was 35 years ago. You were 46 years old at the time, and I wanted to start by asking you about that decision.
Well, I love the firm. I still love the firm. It's the best ever put together. And my father died at 46, and I was 46. I remember that number. And I was in the office every Saturday, 7 o'clock. We said at Fidelity, we get up a basketball game on Saturday. And in Wellington, they couldn't play double solitaire. You know, on Saturday. Every day I enjoyed it. People are fantastic. We had three daughters, and I just wanted to spend more time with my wife and the three daughters. So, and I was lucky enough to, Fidelity said, just stay on. We'll give you a role here working with young analysts and fund managers. So it's been great, great company, the best.
Did you ever think about getting back into the game? Was there ever a moment or a temptation where you said, you know what, I think I could do this better than everyone else out there still, and I want to go for it.
I had all these offers to do a close-end fund.
Okay.
$1 billion, $2 billion, 2% fees. The market's up 30-fold.
Yeah.
30-fold since I left.
Okay.
So if I just did average, it'd be a $60 billion fund.
Yeah. The temptation was never great enough, though.
No. I'd still be working those same hours.
Yeah.
Because one out of every 100 Americans was a Magellan Fund.
Is that right?
One out of every 100 Americans was a Magellan Fund.
Okay.
These are people that $5,000, $10,000 was very meaningful.
Did the weight of that get to you at all while you were running the fund, the level of responsibility?
Yeah.
Okay.
I had a perfect record. I think the market went down 10 times in those 13 years.
Okay.
I went down more every time than the market, every time.
Okay. But you somehow managed to get through those moments when you were down.
Yeah.
How did you do that?
In 87, I got letters from people saying, hang in there, it'll be great, don't worry about it. You know, it was amazing.
I wanted to ask you if there were ever moments where you looked at something that was happening in the market, whether it was a bull market or a bear market, and said to yourself, if I were at Magellan, I know exactly what I would be doing right now with this opportunity. Had you had those moments?
Yeah, I did have that moment when Pets.com came public.
Pets.com?
I says, this makes no sense at all, and then went up. So, yeah, I can't short. But there were so many companies of no value.
Yeah.
And fortunately, Fidelity didn't own those damn things. That was a period to say, wow, what's wrong here? You know.
Okay. I wanted to ask you, who are the professional investors or the corporate leaders or other people on Wall Street that you either admire most today or that you looked at and learned from during your tenure managing the... Who are your heroes or who are your mentors?
I'd say Lee Iacocca would be really up there. Chrysler, Ford and Chrysler, and then Bob Walter at the...
Let's pause. Why Lee Iacocca? What was it about him that you admired?
Well, imagine the Thunderbird at the Mustang at Ford. And then he brings in the minivan and Jeep at Chrysler.
Yeah.
Incredible. It's just a wonderful person. And then, you know, this Bob Walter, when it was Cardinal, he was supplying supermarkets, had a $37 million value when it came public. It's now $37 billion. Mm. This guy, Bob Walter, I mean, he's so good. And I'm trying to think of another fellow I've met. There's so many great entrepreneurs that aren't that well known. I think it's Al Named. He's at... It's an amazing company in Florida. That's up 100-fold. Ben Camerata, TJ Maxx. I mean, TJ Maxx is up 100-fold.
Yeah.
That's Ben Camerata. I mean, those are great people.
One of the things that you've talked about is your...
Watsco is the company, Al Named.
Watsco. One of the things you've talked about is your early introduction to Wall Street. There was a lot of disbelief about the stock market in the house you grew up in. But then you got your first job caddying on the golf course, and all you heard was how much money people were making. Tell us a little bit about that time in your life.
Well, actually, if you grew up in the 40s, you heard about the big one, the Depression.
Yeah.
There's one coming. What'd you think? Risk averse, the bar of four. But I was a caddy, and people would talk about what stocks they're buying. I'd look it up, and a few months later, they were higher.
Yeah.
This is a pretty good deal, you know. So I didn't have money, but I, in addition to talking about their shots, but it's a great role of a caddy because you're like an advisor to somebody. You tell them, you know, if you miss the screen, don't miss it to the right, or don't be short, or you know, line up putts. It's incredible. My friends were delivering newspapers, you know, at 5 a.m. I was making more on Saturdays than making the whole week, so. And the president was, Mr. Johnson was the CEO, and DeJore Sullivan was the president, and I caddied for him. He said, gee, why don't you interview for a job at Fidelity?
How old were you when that offer came?
21 or...
Okay.
So summer of 66, somehow I was the only one to caddy for the president, so I got the job. It was like, I think there were 75 applicants for three spots, but I got the spot and... 66, and so then I had to do 1 year warden, 2 years in the Army, came back in 69. So I owe it all to being a caddy.
What did you have to do at Fidelity to pay your dues to the point where they were willing to give you money to invest for other people?
Yeah, I think they forgot all my mistakes because I had the textile, the worst groups, the textile stocks, the steel stocks, the metal stocks. I don't know how I ever survived that they were... There weren't many winners there.
They gave you the stocks to cover that nobody else cared about?
Well, everybody had groups. Somebody did retailers, somebody did electronics, somebody did oil, somebody did truckers, somebody did railroads. I wound up with the dregs. You know.
I wanted to ask you, what were some of the traits in the investors that you were learning from or the people that you admired in money management? What were some of the qualities in those people or their habits that probably still resonate for investors today?
When I started, we had this person, Alan Gray. He went back to South Africa about 10 years later, but he would work hard, he'd research companies, he'd listen to my stories. He was probably the best role model. I remember Alan Gray.
Okay.
But my peers were all great. I mean, all the people around me, everybody in the research department was really talented, so we're loaded with skill.
It's funny, I interviewed one of your colleagues yesterday, She's a quantitative analyst at Fidelity. And it's so funny to hear you say that because she said the exact same thing. She said, any question I have about markets or the economy, this whole building is filled with talented people who know what's going on. And all I have to do is walk down the hall and get the answer to my question. Right. You still feel that way about the organization today?
Oh, it's unbelievable. I mean, Steve Weimer, John McDowell, Joel Tillinghast, Will Danoff. I mean, you know, it's just like the Yankees were, you know, in the 1920s. We're playing the Yankees right now.
I won't tell you who I'm rooting for. So I thought it would be funny to take some of your legendary quotes and witticisms. They've all been attributed to you. You'll tell me if they're not actually you. But these have been taken from interviews you've given over the years, from the books that you've written, from the things that you've written and published. I thought it'd be fun to share some of these with the audience, and the audience probably can quote some of these by heart, and just have you react to them and tell us where it came from or what the lesson is behind the thing that you were trying to get across. I've got a couple of categories for these quotes. I did a little taxonomy. So the first category involves the risk of investing in stocks. You said, the real key to making money in stocks is not to get scared out of them. Why is that the key to making money in stocks?
Well, more important to that is I have this expression, know what you own.
People, I was going to do that one later. I'll cross it off.
But that's it. That's the most important lesson.
Okay.
Because you'll get shaken out if the stock goes from 10 to 8. You don't know what they're doing. What are you going to do with it? And I was saying earlier, I got a call. I did an ad for Fidelity with Lily Tomlin. She's very close to Barbara Streisand. So I'm on vacation, my wife and two other couples, and my secretary, Paul Sullivan, says, Barbara Streisand's called 3 times. She'd really like to talk to you. And she's very nice, and, you know. I said, sure, I got some time this afternoon. So I call him, and she says, I own all these stocks, and I'm getting up at 5 a.m. and looking at this stuff. And she said, I never did drugs, I never did marijuana. I just can't sleep. What do? I says, tell me 5 things you own. She named 5 companies. I say, okay, what did they do? Mm. She didn't have any idea. She's an incredibly talented person. She had no idea what those companies did.
Right.
So what are you going to do if they go down 50%?
Yeah.
If you don't understand what you own, you're toast.
It sounds so obvious to hear you say it, but it's amazing. You talk about people spend more time researching a refrigerator they're going to buy than they do a stock they're going to invest part of their life savings.
People are very careful. They spend hours, get $50 off on an airplane flight. They look at everything.
Right.
And they'll put $10,000 in some crazy stock they heard on the bus. You know, they have no idea what they're doing. And somebody invented this awful term before I got in the business called play the market.
Play the market. You don't like that term.
That is sometimes a noun, there it's a verb. It's a very dangerous verb. Play the market is not what you do.
Okay.
You buy good companies, and some work, and you have to know what they do. There was this farm in Western Massachusetts, the two companies, Tampax out there, Friendly Ice Cream. You put $1,000 in a month for 10 years. Brilliant idea. He says, if they stop hiring, I'm going to leave.
Okay.
You made $1 million.
Huh.
I mean, people have all these edges. There's people in the steel industry know it's getting better before I do. These people have an edge, and they might as well go to a casino and bet on red, you know.
So by knowing the companies that you're invested in, there's a higher likelihood that you'll be able to stick with them when other people are scared.
Yeah. The average range for a stock on the New York Stock Exchange, the average high, average low, every year is 100%. So the stock might start at 20, sell at 28, finish at 14, finish at 20. It's a 100% move every year.
So it's 50% up, 50% down-ish, and that's how it's a 100% swing in the price.
That's the average stock.
Wow.
And most stocks you're going to buy, they're probably going to go down. The odds, sometimes they go up. If the story's powerful, like Watsco or Chrysler, you might buy it up. Yeah. But if you don't know what they do and it goes down, and I've had people say, this stock's gone from 50 to 1. How much can I lose? And I say, well, wait a second. If somebody put $10,000 in at 50, and you put $50,000 at one, if it goes to zero, who loses the most? I mean, stocks go to zero. I've had them. You know, I wasn't buying them on the way to zero. But stocks go down. If you don't understand what they do, if you can't explain to an 11-year-old in a minute or less why you own it, not the suckers going up. I've heard that one before. Why? What's the story that's coming? They have good business, good balance sheet. They're fine. That's why I own it.
You've instructed investors to write a script for the stock they're going to buy.
Yeah.
Write the story down. Why is this stock going to work? Or why is it undervalued?
Because I've told this to people in high school and college saying, make a paper portfolio,
yeah.
Pick 10 stocks, and watch them over a year or two and say why you bought them. List the reasons and see what happens.
Right.
That's what we're about. We do this. We have those. Our fund managers, they don't wait for the analysts to come in. They're out researching companies. They're on the phone talking to companies. Every fund manager is the highest role of is an analyst, yeah. A fundraiser analyst. We have analysts under that. We have all this information coming in. It's staggering out the information. I could go back in time. We own a lot of Nike. This story's amazing. Own a lot of Nike, and their inventories were out of whack. Not a good sign. It's before the internet. We had to go to a library and get their quarterly report. Our library, Fidelity. We got the came in, we opened up, inventories went down, we backed up the truck. I mean, the concept of, you know, they used to mail it out by mail to the shareholders. Now they have a website, it's everybody on the planet knows what they do.
Yeah.
Information today is unbelievable. If you can't understand, they have company presentations. It's a lot easier to understand what you own today.
So I think you're saying in today's day and age, you have no excuse not to know the companies you own. It's too easy.
You don't need a Bloomberg. They have websites.
Here's another one on risk. You said far more money has been lost by investors preparing for corrections or trying to anticipate corrections than has been lost in corrections themselves. Talk about that.
Well, I think people, they're always worried the market's going down, and it does, as I mentioned. And, 2 years ago, they were saying 2024 was going to be a down year for the economy, and 25 is going to be a down year. I mean,
every year.
I think economists have predicted 33 of the last 11 recessions.
Yes. And with great certainty.
Yeah. And I think, people are, they're basically, you look dumb in this business. You're terrific in this business. You're right 6.5 times out of 10. Yeah. That's a great score.
Yeah.
Even if you're right 5 times out of 10, if you own Costco or Walmart or I can't pronounce NVIDIA. I'm getting close to being able to pronounce it.
I think you nailed it there.
That offsets your mistakes.
Yeah.
You have to have these winners offset mistakes, and that's what we've done for 70 years at Fidelity.
So you've got two more on this topic. I'll read them both. you said you get recessions, you have stock market declines. If you don't understand that's going to happen, then you're not ready, you won't do well in markets. You also said people who succeed in the stock market also accept periodic losses, setbacks, and unexpected occurrences. How important is it for the average, I hate the term average investor, for the typical investor to go into this business understanding there's no way to dance around these things. They're going to take place. You're going to have to live through them. Would you say that's one of the paramount things? Because that's what I think.
Well, the point is, what if somebody has 3 children about to start college in 2 years? They shouldn't be in the stock market.
That's right.
They should be in the money market fund. But it depends. If you got your house, paid down your mortgage, then you can invest. And it's been a great place to be since, year 1900.
Yeah. One of the more timeless things that you've said, and it comes off as sarcastic, but I think the last 15 years have really proven the value of this idea. Coming out of the great financial crisis, the most in vogue style of investing was macroeconomic hedge funds. Because there were a small handful of people who determined that the housing crisis would ultimately bring about a recession. And those people were revered for a couple of years. You've never really been big on trying to outguess everyone else on the economy. Yeah. And you said, if you spend more than 13 minutes analyzing economic and market forecasts, you've wasted 10 minutes. I still quote you to this day when clients call up and they want to talk about the latest labor report or what the Fed's going to do. Tell us, how long did it take you to figure that out? And how much pushback did you get when you said it from people that were economists or focused on the macro?
Well, I don't remember if Fidelity ever had an economist. So we just buy stocks. And
she's here tonight.
So I'd love to get next year's Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
I'd pay at least $5 for next year's Wall Street Journal. Know that, and hands off to the people who did The Big Short. I had no idea how bad the housing market was, how bad people had second mortgages, they had home improvement loans, they were underwater in their house. I had no idea. Hats off to them.
Yeah.
But I look at facts, like what's happened to debt, credit card debt. You can get that now. What's happened to savings rate? What's happened to employment? I'd love to know what's happened in the future. I've been hoping I could get that in the last 81 years. It's not available. So I just deal with what's now, what's happened to used car prices, what's happened to price of oil. And you look at industries that have gone from miserable to getting better, like Chrysler. I mean, I remember people says, gee, you were really good on that show, but how can you possibly recommend Chrysler? It's going bankrupt. Well, they had $2 billion in cash, and they had enough money for the next 3 years. They weren't going bankrupt. So I think the best stocks I had, I think if 100 people did work on it, 99 would say, that's better than I expected. Mm. So I use this for one of our great fund managers, Joel Tillinghast. I wrote a foreword to his book, and I always said, the person that wins the most, in terms of the most rocks, wins the game. And I said, Joel Tillinghast is a great geologist, because if you look at 10 stocks, you'll probably find one that's mispriced.
Yeah.
Look at 20, you'll find two. Look at 40, you'll find four. And that's what we've been doing at Fidelity. We just don't look, we look at everything.
Yeah, so you're not discounting the value of economic data.
Oh, that'd be great.
You're saying if it's not from the future, the market already understands this.
Yeah, I mean, I want to know facts right now.
Yeah.
That's important.
You said behind every stock is a company, find out what it's doing. Some of the great stories about your big investment success involve hands-on observations that you had been able to make, living your real life, being in a supermarket, being in a shopping mall, looking at what people are doing.
Yep.
I think that over the years, that idea has kind of been mischaracterized as if you use the product, it's automatically a good stock, which is not what you meant at all. Could you explain the difference between those two ideas and why that's so important?
Well, a lot of people, I met so many nice people earlier tonight, and a lot of them had read my book, One Up on Wall Street, and I had this story about, I had a great investment. My largest position was in Hanes that had these pantyhose called legs. They weren't that sheer. They really fit, but most pantyhose are being sold in fancy department stores. This was at the supermarket.
Yeah.
And people go to a supermarket once a week. They go to a fancy store once every couple months. My wife went a little more often, but and I went with her. So this was an incredible success. Incredible success. But then a larger company called Kaiser Roth put the thing right next to it. And it was called No Nonsense Pantyhose. Mm. So I went to two different stores, about 65 different pairs of No Nonsense Pantyhose.
Now, what kind of look did you get from the clerk in the process of that activity?
Yeah. It was an odd purchase, but I spread it over three stores. But I gave it out to everybody at Fidelity.
Yeah.
And said, give me some feedback on this. They said, it's not that good.
Okay.
It's not that good.
Okay, so.
And the other one, the first stock I bought in Magellan was Taco Bell. And I had to say, I own this myself. Is it okay?
Who was clapping for Taco Bell? It's not one of my people, was it? Okay.
And so I said, can I buy some stock that I own myself? I said, sure. You just can't sell it after you buy it. You have to hold on. So that's when we had Ma Bell and all these Bell companies. And so I called the trade room. I said, I want to buy Taco Bell. Ned Johnson came down. And he says, what is Taco Bell? And I explained what a taco was. They're only in Southern California. Yeah. They're going to Central California. I didn't get a burrito supreme, but again, I explained what a taco was. Because it's basically a taco has very little meat, a lot of protein. You can sell a really good meal for a low price. And I got robbed on it because Pepsi-Cola bought Pizza Hut, and they bought some Kentucky Fried Chicken. They bought Taco Bell to sell Pepsi.
Right.
This stock would have gone to 500.
Yeah.
My largest position was 18. They bought it at 30.
Okay.
Would have gone to 500, 600. But they bought it to sell Pepsi.
When Chipotle came along, did you avail yourself of the opportunity?
I did. But how I miss Starbucks, I don't get that. You know. Because I own Dunkin' Donuts. How did I miss Starbucks? I mean,
you missed Starbucks.
Brain cramping. I didn't buy it. Well.
Okay. You've got some great quotes about portfolio management, and here are a few of them. You said, in the long run, a portfolio of well-chosen stocks and or mutual funds can outperform the most sophisticated investment strategy. I think there is a cottage industry today, and probably there has been for a long time, of people selling complexity to investors.
Right.
It's one of the best sellers on Wall Street. Just that simple statement, I think, very much is something that most of us would associate with Fidelity, and very much is something that we would associate with you. Why do people need to hear that message today?
Well, it's funny, earlier on, I met maybe 100 people to chat with them, and somebody's in the audience, they shovel chicken poop, and they use the word rhymes with hit. Who's, is the person here with the chicken poop in New Jersey? And he's
waving at the top, you won't be able to see.
Okay.
Congrats.
But he decided to be a serious investor, do hard work. He said he's done extremely well.
Yeah. So do you think that that's still possible today, given how armed to the teeth professional investors are with data and tools and high-frequency access? Is it still possible to be someone who, just on a part-time basis, when they get home from work, reads about stocks and makes decisions? You still believe in that?
Well, I'll tell you a story personally. My daughters get me an iPod. This is before the iPhone.
Yep.
And the PC business was terrible. They're selling for $800, making $20. They had a decent balance sheet. The iPod was $200, and they make $150 on it.
Yeah.
The iPod financed the iPhone. You know, it just did some work. And the company had $300 million in cash.
This is Apple in
Apple.
2001-ish.
I'm not sure.
Right. Okay.
But, things change. Companies are dynamic. Something comes along, and things go from terrible, or we use a term more appropriate, crappy, to semi-crappy, to better, to terrific.
Yeah.
Something happened at Apple. And they were now going to make a lot of money. I had no idea. I have a phone on me, an iPhone. But I had no idea what's falling. But the stock easily was a triple, just on that alone.
This is one of your more famous quotes, and made famous by being re-quoted by Warren Buffett. You said, selling your winners and holding your losers is like cutting the flowers and watering the weeds.
Yep.
That's a great one. That's an all-time.
Yeah.
You were known to hold on to winners for a very long period of time.
Yeah.
A lot of people were quick to take profits so they could say, I won.
Yeah.
Tell us the Warren Buffett connection to that quote and why it's meaningful.
I don't know how I got my landline, but I got this call. Annie, I think it was like 7, our middle daughter, says there's a Warren Buffett on the phone here. Yeah. You know, like
What year do you think this is, if you could remember? Well, what era is this?
I don't know.
Who knows?
It was way beyond the dark ages. I don't know.
All right.
Yeah. But so I pick up the phone. This is Warren Buffett from Omaha, Nebraska. My annual report's due in 2 weeks. I'd love a quote. Can I use it? This is all in about 3 seconds. You know. He says, what's the quote? He says, you know, getting rid of your winners and holding your losers is like, you know, wiring the weeds and cutting the flowers. I said, it's yours.
Yeah.
I said, if you don't come to Omaha and see me, your name will be mud in Nebraska.
Did you do it?
Oh, yeah, many times.
You built a relationship with Warren.
Played bridge together. He's the best. I mean, there's no... Imagine, he bought Apple like 8 years after I was that iPod story and made fivefold.
Yes.
And he had a huge position in IBM. It was going down. He says, I love stocks going down. I think IBM's great. He totally reversed. He got the hell out of IBM.
Yeah.
He's the best.
Yeah. Round of applause. I wanted to ask you, is there any idea from the investing realm that you once believed that you no longer believe in? Or is there something that you've changed your mind about as time has gone on? Or do you still mostly believe all of the things that you did in the 70s and the 80s?
It's the same thing. I mean, this success of Amazon, Costco, Walmart. I mean, forget the technology companies or Oracle. I mean, that's what's done well for average investors, and Fidelity was heavy invested in all those.
Okay.
Just using public information. We look at a lot of companies and we find some companies that are turning around. Like, we bought some gold stocks when people hated gold.
Yeah. So the business doesn't change that much. The names of the companies change, the management changes, but the business is still very much as it was when you were a practitioner.
Well, I think there's one major change. I think 15 years ago, there was 8,000 public companies.
It's about 3,000 now.
Now there's 3 or 4.
Yeah.
So part of the upside, that 10-bagger that I love, that term, sometimes you have this great stock. If you hold on to it, it's not the Pepsi stealing it. Private equity, you think the stock's going to 30, it's 3. And private equity buys the whole damn thing out at 6.
They take it away from the market.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's painful.
I wanted to ask you about the modern stock market, specifically the AI boom that's been, for the last 3 years, arguably the biggest driving force behind earnings growth, behind revenue growth, excitement about stocks. What do you think about it when you watch it, or how involved are you with AI stocks with your own money right now?
I have zero AI stocks, and I literally couldn't pronounce NVIDIA until about 8 months ago. But we have people at Fidelity that are very tech. I am the lowest tech guy ever. I mean, my wife is mechanical, my daughter's mechanical. I can't do anything with computers, so I just have yellow pads and a phone. Yeah.
From your position as a third party to this, do you think investors have chased these ideas too far? Are there echoes of the 1999-2000 era to you when you look at it, or are you open-minded about it and you say maybe this is not going to end as badly as that instance did?
I have no idea.
Okay.
Don't have any idea. I have a lot of stocks I like. Okay. Not in that category.
So let's talk about your current portfolio. What are the stocks that you like today?
Fidelity doesn't let me do this anymore, so.
Okay.
In fact, they don't let any employees do that.
Because okay.
I remember I was on television, and I was saying how Coca-Cola is a spectacular company, but based on what they're doing right now, I think in 10 years, I think the stock will be the same price. I mean, the stock's priced in the next 10 years of growth.
Yeah.
And we happen to manage Coke's IRA. I mean, this did not go over big.
They weren't thrilled with that. Okay.
It was not a big success.
So for good reasons. One of the things that you talked about in your books was the necessity of not chasing glamorous stocks. Yeah. And one of the things you said you liked the best is when a company got itself into trouble. Yep. Where it was a salvageable situation, but nobody wanted to be caught dead owning it. One of the examples that you used famously was waste management. You said,
yep.
Nobody wants anything to do with this stock. Number one, they're involved with garbage. Number two, everybody thinks the mafia controls it.
Yeah.
You made a lot of money there.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think that that heuristic for selecting stocks that are off the beaten path still works for investors?
Well, again, under my thesis that if 10 people look at it, 9 will say this is better than expected.
Yeah.
I don't think people are looking at waste management. They just wouldn't look at it. So stocks are mispriced when there's a lot of no one in the class of Fidelity. We have a lot of good competitors.
Yeah.
And they're doing the same work we're doing. And sometimes they're not looking at certain categories of stocks. And what I also found out, I've had companies that were losing $6 a share, and things got, they started getting better. The industry hadn't recovered, but they had certain things, and now they're losing $2 a share.
Right. Still not good, but not as bad.
But I think that's $4 a share improvement. Then they went from losing to making two, the stock quadrupled.
Yeah.
It's the same $4.
Okay.
Why weren't people looking when they went from, what were they doing? They went from losing six to losing two in a bad environment. Things didn't improve. They were doing something right.
Can you tell us about the oxymorons of Wall Street? And some of us are here in the room. It was very original. You went on this kind of tour de force. I don't want to call it a tirade, but this sort of monologue about don't be fooled into thinking just because someone's a professional that they can do better than you or they know more than you. Warren's got a great quote about this. He said, Wall Street is the only place where people take a Rolls Royce to get advice from somebody who took the subway. And in fairness, I took the subway to my first job on Wall Street for a long time.
Yeah.
But you talked about the oxymorons, people that thought they knew everything just because they had proximity to the exchange.
Yep.
And I think you were giving a pep talk to the reader of the book, telling them, don't think that you can't be good at this too. You still believe that?
Absolutely. I mean, I just think people at Fidelity, that if they work hard, they're careful, and things are not clear. I have a term like in poker term, the next card to turn over. This next card to turn over, I don't know what it's going to be. It could be positive, it could be negative, but 2 years from now, this company's going to be better.
Yeah.
And if the next card turns over positive, buy it. But I think you should buy some now. The next quarter may not be better. I mean, we don't know. Companies get really tight in these quiet periods. So you're doing your best you can. But there's three things going to make this company have higher earnings in 2 to 3 years. We should own it right now.
Okay. And you still think that approach is still the way people should be thinking and not think that somebody knows more than them?
Well, I think people tend to concentrate on what's hitting the new high list.
Yeah.
And that's a good place to operate. I mean, at one point, BJ's was on the new high list. At one point, you know, Ross Stores is on the new high list, or Carvana is on the new high list. So
yeah,
companies on the new high list can go up, but I look at the stocks and they're on the new low list.
Okay.
Most of them are crap, but some of them are good.
That style of investing has fallen out of favor in recent years. Do you think it'll make a comeback?
I hope so.
some call it value investing, some call it bottom fishing, whatever the term is.
Yeah.
Okay, you still think there's something there?
Well, we get one of the great managers ever, Bruce Johnstone. Bruce, you're here somewhere.
Yeah, right? Bruce is here. Bruce Johnstone's in the audience tonight.
He's a superstar buying down-out companies with a dividend yield.
Yeah.
Turn around, he worked incredibly hard, did a lot longer than I did. He's a superstar, and he's a great person to boot. But he was very thorough and careful and prudent. And just like me, he was wrong, you know, 4 times out of 10.
He's saying 3, only 3. I understand you're not particularly investing per se in the Magnificent Seven stocks, but you've always been an admirer of great businesses. These are, I think you'd agree, these are among the greatest publicly traded companies we've ever seen in America. These are companies that, yes, they have trillion-dollar market caps, and they're not cheap.
Right.
But these are companies with 30 and 40% profit margins, 20% revenue growth,
yep,
year after year after year.
Yep.
You must, surely you must be impressed by these companies.
Yeah. Facebook or Meta is an incredible company.
Yeah.
Microsoft's a great company. Google's a great company. Amazon's a staggering company. I'm a little vague on Tesla, but this BYD's making a car now in Hungary. It's a third of the price and a good car. I mean, I can't get this humanoid thing about, but every employee at Fidelity, we call in at 10:15 and say, I'd like to buy these three stocks, sell these three stocks, and they say, nope, can't do it. Fidelity's buying or selling. Every employee does that. So I don't have a chance of buying Meta or Amazon because Fidelity's buying, but that's fair.
You could buy the Fidelity Spartan Index Fund if you want exposure to those.
I own a lot of Fidelity funds.
Yeah. One of the concerns that probably a lot of people in the audience have right now, large cap stocks in general are selling at some of the highest multiples we've ever seen.
Yep.
Historically high, not the highest ever, but in the decile, let's say.
Yep.
So we're selling currently S&P 500, 22 times trailing 12 months earnings. Granted, earnings are growing, interest rates are falling. It sort of makes sense when you think about this being a CapEx boom and low unemployment. There are a lot of justifiable reasons for it. Do you worry about future returns for the investor who puts a dollar to work today in the market?
I'll ask somebody in the room, do we run Costco's IRA or Walmart's IRA? Because Costco's like at 55 times earnings.
Costco has an AI stock multiple, but they sell paper towels.
It's a great company, man.
Yeah.
55 times earnings. Ooh. Or Walmart is 70 years old. You know, Sam Walton was at JCPenney, invented this great formula, went to small towns. Imagine, here's an example of being, sometimes you don't have to be in the first inning. Walmart comes public. You said, gee, it's a little town in Southwest and Southeast. I'm not sure about them. So 10 years after they went public, the stock's up tenfold. It's gone up tenfold. I missed it. It's now up 80-fold since then. These 10 years, they're a 25-year-old company.
Yeah.
And they copied the Kmart formula. They're lower cost. They went to the big cities. They could kill Kmart, kill Sears. So it went up 80-fold after going up tenfold. It's a 25-year-old company, 10 years in public. They're in 18% of the United States. Then they went to 19, then to 20, then to 23.
Yeah.
And and then they had Sam's Club. And I had the same example at McDonald's. McDonald's was my biggest position. People said, it's all over for McDonald's. I said, well, wait a second. Why is that? Well, how many more McDonald's can I have? Well, I think they can do really well in Europe. There's 450 McDonald's in France.
Yeah.
In France. Germany, 380. There's over 300 in England. There's 300 in Spain. There's more McDonald's outside the United States. So McDonald's went up tenfold after that. People said, McDonald's is done. They didn't think it through.
Is the message to that the fact that a stock has already been successful tells you nothing about how much more successful it could be in the future?
No, the facts were at that point they had 20 stores in France on the way to 400. They had 20 in Germany. They had 20 in Spain. This was not an idea. They were doing it.
Yeah.
And people were lining up to buy a Big Mac everywhere.
Right. I wanted to ask you, in the time that we have remaining, a couple of other things about the modern market, just so we could all get your take on them. And if you have no opinion, that's okay too. In the last week, the SEC has said they would study an idea proposed by President Trump to ease up on the quarterly reporting burden for public companies and allow companies to report earnings on a semi-annual basis, which is how they do it in the UK. Do you have an opinion, not a political opinion, but do you have an opinion on what that means for investors or whether or not that's something we should celebrate or have cause for concern? Yeah. Is that something that you think about?
I haven't really devoted a lot of attention to that, but I think 3 months is a very short period.
Yeah.
A very short period, and you measured whether, maybe the year before was very strong. So you're up against a strong current. So there's some merit to having a longer period to see what's really happened in the company than just 3 months. So I have not made a decision on that one.
I wanted to ask you about the meme stock phenomenon that took place during the pandemic. From my perspective, and I'd love to hear if you agree with me or not, from my perspective, obviously there were some elements of that that were reckless, but the byproduct is we got 25 or 30 million people to open their first brokerage account, mostly people under the age of 30, where the prior generation was very slow to embrace stocks. So I sort of looked at it like it had a silver lining.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that, or do you have a different take?
The market bottom in 82 was 777.
Yeah.
Not 7,000, 777.
The Dow.
Dow.
Yeah.
So we've had an incredible market since 82. We've had, 10 or 12 declines, but maybe a few more. So people today, they're not used to, everybody I knew grew up, they were warned, the big one's coming. We've had 11 recessions in World War II. We've never had a big one.
Yeah.
But imagine in the Depression, we didn't have Social Security. It wasn't Social Security. What a cruel invention. People, when they retired, they got older, they moved in with their family. The family had to cut back on their spending. Yeah. We didn't have unemployment compensation. We didn't have the SEC. The SEC did not exist.
Yeah.
Did not exist. There's so many things that are better, and we had a Federal Reserve that was asleep to boot. So I think there was a lot of things that, there's margin requirements now. I mean, this 1929, no one jumped out of windows.
That was fabricated, you said.
1% of Americans own stocks, 1929.
I don't think a lot of people understand that.
Yep.
The losses were very contained to a small group of people.
But we had an incredible depression.
Yeah.
30% of people out of work, not enough food, terrible farming environment. It was awful. And people went through that. I've read stories about it. It was grim.
You think we have evolved the economy and the markets to the point where it would be very difficult to repeat the quote-unquote big one?
Well, we've had 11 tests.
11 recessions since.
And no one's ever got worse than, 5, 6% decline in GDP. There's a lot of cushions now.
Yeah.
63% of Americans own their house. That was not true in the 1920s. People have IRAs. If they're Fidelity, they're not going to panic. People are careful with their savings. I mean, the GI Bill allowed people to buy houses. With 5% down, create a lot of people with wealth. Most wealth in America is in their house.
Yeah.
And that was not true in the 20s. People were renting, rent went up. I mean, there's so many buffers now that, it's incredible how many positives there are. I mean, we had a lot of tests. We had many opportunities to have a big one. And we've had some incredibly bad presidents, some bad congresses. We've had bad economists, and we've made it through. It's a pretty good system.
I like that message for people who are overdosing on Great Depression content on their social media feeds and constantly being fed that as a realistic possibility. I wanted to ask you one last question. This is an audience of some of the most successful, dedicated, self-directed investors, customers of Fidelity. First of all, give yourselves a round of applause. As someone who for decades has been the leading advocate of the self-directed investor, is there any parting words of wisdom for this audience or anything that you think they need to hear from you that maybe they haven't heard from anyone else or haven't heard in a while? Is there any encouragement that you'd like to offer? We'd love to hear it.
Well, I think this is a special group of friends. These people do hard work. They're careful. They're prudent. They buy stocks. They understand what they own. That's not true of most people. And my generation growing up, if you worked for a telephone company, if you worked for a utility, a gas, whatever it was, you had a pension.
Yeah.
Didn't worry about it. Now you have an IRA, the company matches it. You've got to decide what you want to do with it.
You're responsible now for your own retirement in a way that prior generations didn't have to think about.
You have to have it right. You have to decide. But I had a son-in-law. He wasn't happy with the company he's working for. And they were going to, let's say he's going to put $5,000 in, and they were going to match it. He says, I don't want to do that. He says, well, could I put $5,000 in and they'll match it? That's a double every year. Can I participate in your IRA? You know. And I'd love to tell the story about this fear, this AI fear.
Please.
So, in fact, I was talking to Josh earlier. I was listening to a conference call. This company supplies semiconductor equipment. They were in this industry. And it was so sad. I was so sad. The poor CEO was talking. He's talking about A1, you know, the steak sauce. Yeah. And my 11-year-old grandchild knows the artificial intelligence. He's calling A1. And there must be some people saying, it's not A1, it's AI. Right? But there's this fear that all jobs are going to go away. So I get a good example. 1984, they split up AT&T.
The baby bells. And created
nine baby bells.
Including Taco Bell.
Yeah, Taco Bell was... Right. That was a Mexican
Southern Bell, yeah. Taco Bell, okay. Yeah, yeah.
So they split up. 1 million people worked for AT&T. We had 100 million jobs. One out of every 100 Americans worked at AT&T. So it's now, it was 84. So it's what, 40 years later. This industry had phenomenal growth. There were no cell phones then. Remember pay phones? Anybody remember pay phones? There's texting. I mean, what you do on your phone? This has been one of the greatest growth industries. If you add together Verizon, T-Mobile, AT&T, they now have 400,000 employees. We went from 1 million to 400,000. It's 153 million Americans working today. We've gone from 100 million Americans working to 153.
Yeah.
It's a great country. We're creative. So this incredible conversation, America creates, China duplicates, and Europe legislates.
Right. So from your point of view, the people displaced by AI and other innovations to come in the future, they'll be doing something else. It's unlikely they'll be sitting there saying, I wish I still had my job that AI took away.
Yeah, I think more importantly, you know, one job is going to go away. These are good paying jobs.
Yeah.
The people that drive a truck, a tractor trailer, from a manufacturing firm to a distribution center on highways, not through Beacon Hill, they go back that night, that should be automated.
Yeah. And likely will be, you would say?
I would say in 20 years, we'll lose 500,000 jobs.
Yeah.
That's a really, and safety will be better, costs will go down. That's more important to me than AI. And those are people who work hard. They don't need a...
Sorry, automation is going to have a bigger impact than AI, you're saying?
Automation has been incredible the last 50 years. And we've gone from 100 million jobs to 153, and Eastman Kodak's gone down, Peter Tire's gone down, Sears has gone away. I mean, all the growth is new companies, and companies with 100 to 200 employees or less. The largest pharma companies have fewer employees than they did 50 years ago.
Yeah.
The largest 500 companies have fewer employees than they did 50 years ago. All the growth in this country is entrepreneurs starting a little shop, starting something else that makes our country great. And the important thing is banks will lend to them. Yeah. It's a great book, The Shoe Dog. Has anybody read The Shoe Dog?
Shoe Dog, sure. Well, Phil Knight.
Incredible. I mean, you know, it's a great read.
Yeah. I want to thank you so much for spending some time with us tonight. How about a round of applause for Peter Lynch, ladies and gentlemen? I also want to thank the folks at Fidelity for putting this event on, inviting us all here to be together. Congratulations on the new app. And thank you so much to the whole team who made this happen. Really appreciate it. Lastly, I'd be remiss if I didn't thank my team who set up a lot of the equipment that you see surrounding us tonight and will be tirelessly working on this video, editing the audio so that the people who couldn't be here with us have an opportunity to watch it or listen to it later. So ladies and gentlemen, Daniel, John, Nicole, and Graham, Rob, Duncan, please give them a round of applause. Thank you guys so much. Okay, that's it from us. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being a part of this. We'll see you soon. Thank you.